From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. She's known as the First Lady of Song, the Queen of Jazz. Ella Jane Fitzgerald overcame poverty, abuse, and racism to build an international career that spanned seven decades and a charitable foundation in her name. We talk with Jeffrey Mark, author of Ella, a biography of the legendary Ella Fitzgerald, who walks us through the story behind the music.
When you find out about her story, it's like, goodness gracious, how did this woman survive her real life and become this icon?
We learn about some of her personal and professional relationships, her vulnerabilities, and what motivated her insatiable love of connecting to a live audience. It's on the record after the news. Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. She is the First Lady of Song, the Queen of Jazz. Ella Jane Fitzgerald's stellar career spanned seven decades. She left an imprint on music that will last forever. It's nearly impossible to encapsulate a life so accomplished and a talent that reaches beyond words. But our guest today, Jeffrey Mark, dedicated more than a decade to researching and writing Ella, a biography of the legendary Ella Fitzgerald. Mark is also a singer, comedian, and Emmy Award winner. He's been described as a walking encyclopedia of show business history. His book is now available with a two-CD set that illustrates the scope of Ella Fitzgerald's unparalleled career. He'll be performing some of her songs at Germano's Piattini Cabaret next Wednesday, April 25th, her 101st birthday. There will also be a book signing. And now he joins us by phone from his home near Palm Springs, California. Welcome to the show, Jeffrey.
Good afternoon. You flatter me. Keep going. Wow, I feel great.
Well, let's start with you. You have roots in Baltimore, yeah?
Absolutely. Although I was born in Brooklyn, New York, which is only a three-hour drive from Baltimore, we moved there in the summer of 1967, and I spent my last 2 years of elementary school and went to Old Court Junior High and Randallstown High School, so Baltimore is very near and dear to my heart.
As somebody reads this book, they can feel your admiration and love for Ella and her music. What prompted you to write it?
I like to write about people who are the very, very best at what they do. And if you talk to musicians, if you talk to other singers, Ella, 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 it's always Ella at the top of the list. Most singers who study what is now considered the Great American Songbook, they say listen to Ella's version first and then go on and do your research. She's always the go-to point for everybody. That intrigued me, and that's why I wanted to make sure that her story was told, not just because she's the best at what she does, but when you find out about her story, it's like, goodness gracious, how did this woman survive her real life and become this icon? So I like writing about both sides of it.
And we need, obviously, to hear her voice right away. Here is a clip from Atiskit Atasket, the song that you refer to as her first monster hit. It really launched her career. Let's listen.
Atiskit Atasket, a brown and yellow basket. I send a letter to my mommy on the way. I dropped it, I dropped it, I dropped it. Yes, on the way I dropped it, a little girlie picked it up and put it in her pocket.
Did Ella Fitzgerald have control over her career?
Well, that's a good question, and the answer is probably yes, no, and maybe. When we're talking about Atiskit Atasket, we're going all the way back to the 1930s. Now, the clip you just played was a redo that she did in the late 1950s. But the original Atiskit Atasket was part of her time and life with Chick Webb's orchestra in the 1930s. And Atiskit Atasket really shows you the first time she tries to take control a little bit of her career. There was a young man named Al Feldman who was the arranger for the Chick Webb Orchestra. And she came to him and said, you know, my mother used to sing me this little sing-song lullaby thing when I was going to bed as a kid. Let's swing that. And Al said, no, Ella, that's really a bad idea. And she said, "Oh, really? Would you like to continue to keep writing arrangements for me? Because if I won't use them, Chick Webb will fire you." And he said, "By golly, Ella, that's a great idea. Let's swing a nursery rhyme."
Hardball.
He went home and wrote this arrangement and came back the next day. And she loved the arrangement, but she didn't like the lyrics. So she rewrote them using the parlance of the jive people of the day, the hipsters who came to the Savoy Ballroom to dance all night to their music. And they recorded it, and it went huge. It was a million seller across the board. It wasn't just for the African-American population. Everybody loved it. And that was the first time she put her foot down and said, "No, this is going to be my way." But more often than not, her managers and agents held sway, and she did more or less what they told her to do.
Your biography of Ella Fitzgerald looks at what you call the story behind the music, too. Talk about that.
Yes. Well, who knew until you start doing research? Who knew that Ella's mother died when she was a teenager? Who knew that the man who was her mother's Portuguese lover raped her and berated her and beat her? Who knew that Ella ran away and was caught and sent to a girls' reformatory where she was literally tortured? Who knew that Ella ran away to the streets of Harlem and was a numbers runner and was a lookout for prostitutes so she'd have some place to live and have a roof over her head? Who knew these things? So the more I was able to reveal, each thing I revealed made me ask 16 more questions. But the big question is, how does this girl with no support system and no family and no money and no home become this big star? She's a teenager recording her first song, and 3 years later, she's the biggest singer in the country. How does that happen? That I found fascinating, and that story is in the book.
It is fascinating. Why was it important for Ella to keep her private life and her past away from the public eye?
Well, I think it's a combination of two things. Ella Fitzgerald was an enormously shy, personally shy woman, meaning on stage, you couldn't beat her. But if you sat with her or she attended a party or was anywhere not in the public eye, tremendously shy. And then you have the times in which she becomes a star. In the 1930s and 40s, if there was anything in your background that had anything criminal or anything less than, you know, mommy and daddy and a white picket fence and the perfect childhood, people, you couldn't become a star. Everybody's background had to be sanitized for their own protection. Just most folks' backgrounds weren't as awful as Ella's was.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with author and performer Jeffrey Mark about his book, Ella, a biography of the legendary Ella Fitzgerald. He'll be signing books and performing at Germano's Piattini Cabaret next Wednesday. Let's hear another clip from Lullaby of Birdland.
Oh, Lullaby of Birdland, that's what I always hear when you sigh. Never in my wordland could there be ways to reveal in a phrase how I feel. Have you ever heard?
Why was this an important song in Ella's repertoire?
Because there are eras. In every singer's life, there are eras. Ella had the era of being the big band singer in the 30s into the early 40s, and she was number one in the country for a while. Well, Chick Webb died. Her sidemen got drafted because of World War II. She inherited the big band. She was the first African-American female to lead a big band. But then she was left sort of on her own to be just another female singer. And in the 1940s, her career did a kind of a roller coaster. She'd have a song that would hit for a while, then a long time would go by, and she wouldn't have a song on the charts. She was playing theaters and nightclubs, but not the best ones. And then in the early 1950s, as her voice matured and as Norman Granz took over as her manager, although they fought constantly with the dear old Decca Records to record better things, at least things like Lullaby of Birdland started happening for her, where she had new hits. extended her life so that now, as a woman in her 30s, she's still a star. She's still a name act. And it was the beginning of Ella transforming from being an admired female singer to just about getting to the point where Norman completely takes over her life, and she goes from being a singer to being a superstar. But Lullaby of Birdland is a song we know only because of Ella. It was her hit, and she sang it for the rest of her life. And it's a remarkable thing. Most singers have about a five-year range where that's about all they get for being famous. And the rest of their lives, they're singing the three or four songs they made famous. Ella always kept pushing forward. There was always something new. And Lullaby of Birdland is a good example of any as Ella in the early 1950s swinging. Because by this point, she really was becoming the best jazz singer there was.
That's author and performer Jeffrey Mark. We're talking about his book, Ella, a biography of the legendary Ella Fitzgerald. He'll be performing and signing books at 6 p.m. next Wednesday, April 25th, at Germano's Piattini Cabaret, 300 South High Street in Little Italy. This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cass. Quick break. When we're back, more of Ella's music, more about her career. We'll hear about the pivotal performance that transformed her from superstar to legend. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking this morning with Jeffrey Mark about his book, Ella, a biography of the legendary Ella Fitzgerald. He'll be performing some of her songs, telling stories, and signing books at Germano's Piattini Cabaret next Wednesday. You write at length about Ella's longtime manager and producer, Norman Granz. Talk a bit about their relationship.
Norman must be given tons and tons of credit. He was a West Coast jazz producer who, long before it became, quote-unquote, the right thing to do, felt that the bigotry in music that was happening back then was wrong. He insisted that every place his people played was integrated. He fought for African-American performers to be treated equally and with respect. And although he didn't really like Ella in the beginning, meaning he didn't get her music, once he had a chance to really see her perform live, because he was only judging this on her recorded music, he took over. And he is the one who pushed for her to sing the Great American Songbook songs. And he fought for her. He wanted to be able to record her. Decca Records didn't want to let her go. And he made this deal. Think about this. They were going to make a film of the Benny Goodman story, and they wanted to use Benny's original musicians who were all still alive. Well, they were all under personal contracts to Norman. So he said, you know what? I'll give you the musicians. You give me Ella. And Decca let her go, and Norman said, I'm starting Verve Records. Now we're going to have you singing the best. And the best was, the very first one was the Cole Porter songbook. When that came out, everybody treated Ella differently. They looked at her with a new pair of glasses and meant, my goodness gracious, this woman can sing anything and interpret anything. And for many people to this day, her versions of those Cole Porter songs are the best. And she went on to do Rodgers and Hart, Irving Berlin, Duke Ellington, George Gershwin, Harold Arlen, the great songs of the great American composers of the 20th century, sung by Ella, done to arrangements by the greatest arrangers that were, the best of which was Nelson Riddle. And that took her to superstar status.
Let's hear a clip of one of those Cole Porter songs, Miss Otis Regrets.
Miss Otis regrets she's unable to lunch today. Madam, Miss Otis regrets she's unable to lunch today. She is sorry to be delayed, but last evening down in Lover's Lane she strayed. Madam,
Tell us about that song.
That's a fascinating cut because the entire album was arranged by Buddy Brigman, except for this song. It's just my friend Paul Smith playing the piano and Ella singing. Ella didn't understand the song, and it's a hard song to understand. It didn't come from a film. It didn't come from a Broadway show. Cole Porter, just to stay in practice, woke up every morning, had coffee and a cigarette, and wrote a song just to stay in practice. This is a song he wrote one day. It's very darkly humorous. And one has to understand about butlers and society people to get the lyrics. And Buddy explained the song to Ella so that she could perform it the way Porter intended it. And it is one of the best loved songs on the album. It was such a minor thing in his life that she rescued this song from obscurity. Ella turned it into a hit. Ella turned it into one of those classic forever green songs that people sing, and people are still recording it. If Ella hadn't done it, nobody else would have done it. But this is one of the songs I'll be singing at the club to the same arrangement. I don't imitate Ella. I can't. Nobody can. That's why she's the best.
That's author and performer Jeffrey Mark here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his book, Ella, a biography of the legendary Ella Fitzgerald. He'll be performing and telling stories at Germano's Piattini Cabaret next Wednesday. There's an anecdote about Ella's performance in Berlin of Mac the Knife that you say was pivotal. Before we have a listen, set it up for us. What happened?
It's 1930s Germany, and there is this musical about a slasher, and it's a big hit. And the people who wrote this, all the people involved, were Jewish and left Nazi Germany before it was too late. Came to New York. The show was produced in English, off-Broadway and on, and the same song sung in a very lugubrious, funereal way. Now, 20 years go by, and for some reason, Bobby Darin records this song as this up-tempo, finger-snapping, swinging number. And it hits number one on the charts. Louis Armstrong hears it and decides to record it for his next album. And his version hits number one on the charts. Very, very rare. So now we're in Berlin in February of 1960, and Ella is about to perform for 10,000 people in what was then called West Berlin. And Norman Granz comes backstage and says to her, Ella, I really want you to go out there and sing Mac the Knife. And Ella, being the obedient client of his, said, no, I will not sing Mac the Knife. I don't like the song. I don't understand it. I don't know the lyrics. And Norman said, we're in Germany. They don't speak English. It won't matter what you sing, but they'll recognize the tune as being German. And Paul Smith, the same pianist I spoke about a moment ago, was backstage and said, Ella, I'll play this little vamp behind you. Just sing what you want, and when you're done, we'll go on to the next thing. Who will know? Well, she went out there, introduced the song by saying, we've never heard a girl sing it, and I'm not sure I know the words. And the song is kind of like a blues. It tells a story in small stanzas. By the time she got to the third stanza, she forgot the words. I think she forgot she was in Germany. And I could rhapsodize about what she did next very longly, but I will tell you that on her feet, she wrote a brand new song. All the lyrics fit the meter of the song. All the lyrics rhymed exactly where they should have, as if she'd taken 2 or 3 months to write all of this.
And let's hear part of that. This is a clip from Mac the Knife in Berlin in 1960. This is toward the end of the song. She actually won Best Vocal Performance by a Female for that improvisational performance.
And Best Album, 2 Grammys for that. And the audience, because Norman was wrong, the audience did understand English, and they knew exactly what she had done, the genius of what she had done. And And they gave her an ovation like I've never heard. And the energy filled her so she followed that with a 7.5-minute version of How High the Moon. Those two songs together are the finest examples of jazz singing that ever have been and probably ever will be. And that's the moment she becomes a legend.
And the other thing it's an example of is her extraordinary relationship with an audience. I mean, you wrote that Ella Fitzgerald performed until she physically no longer could. What did she get from performing for a live audience?
When you're born with this kind of genius talent, and that applies to so few people, it's part of your DNA to use that talent. Here is a woman, I've already told you about her background, the awful things she had to live through. Living through being an African-American, I mean, it's not easy today. In the 1930s and 40s and 50s, it was just plain awful. And women were not treated with equality back then. So she has all these barriers. Where does she get acceptance? On the stage. Where does she get consistent love? On the stage. Ella loved her audiences even more than we loved her and had as much respect for us as we had for her. So she never wanted to retire or not be in front of them. Literally, like you said, until she could no longer get out on a stage. Into the early 1990s, this is a 7-decade career, Ella was out there making us happy because we made her happy.
You saw her perform more than 24 times.
Oh, yes.
What was it like for you to experience that?
That electricity between her and the audiences. I've been lucky. I've growing up in Baltimore and New York, I've seen hundreds of famous people perform live. It was different with Ella. It wasn't just a clack of people or a specific following or gay men screaming for her. It was everybody. You went in the audience. There were African-Americans and Caucasian people and Asian people and Latino people and young and old and straight and gay and conservative and liberal. Across the board, everybody came together and was just entranced by her. There were times, like at Carnegie Hall, people's feet were stomping so much, I was afraid the building was going to collapse. I heard one person say the audience went so crazy they started unscrewing the furniture. That's how the audiences reacted to her. Not in a drugged frenzy, not drunken, just from their hearts, the energy that came out towards her. I've never seen anything like that.
She left such a legacy of music, and there's also an Ella Fitzgerald Charitable Foundation. What does it do?
Her money that she left behind when she passed away has gone into the Ella Fitzgerald Charitable Foundation. It's a foundation that helps the working poor stay afloat. And this was very, very close to Ella's heart. It's why she made sure, after she was no longer here to give to charity, that there'd be a charity to help the kind of people she liked to help. Good people, hardworking people, who for whatever reasons are struggling. A portion of the book is going to the charity. Some of the money I earn on the road is going to the charity. And I heartily suggest you folks out there, if there's a charity you want to support, go look at the Ella Fitzgerald Charitable Foundation.
What can patrons expect at your performance at Germano's next week?
A lot of emotion, because as it turns out, some old high school chums I haven't seen in 4 decades are going to be there to cheer me on. So I will be reminiscing about Ella. I'll also be reminiscing about living in Baltimore, what Baltimore was like in the 1960s and 1970s, what my high school was like. Randallstown High School was the number 2 high school in the country back then, besides Beverly Hills High. So I'll be talking about me. I'll be talking about Ella, singing her songs, and hopefully feeling the love. I have never performed for my peers before from high school. This will be a first. So it'll be a very, very special night. And I'd love to share with as many people who can come.
Thanks for this conversation. Thanks a lot.
Oh, it is my pleasure to be with you and to be in Baltimore.
Jeffrey Mark wrote, Ella, a biography of the legendary Ella Fitzgerald. He'll be performing and telling stories next Wednesday, April 25th, Ella Fitzgerald's 101st birthday, at 6 p.m. at Germano's Piattini Cabaret, 300 South High Street, Little Italy, Baltimore. He'll also sign books. We have a link to information about the book and the cabaret performance at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for listening On the Record. Join us again tomorrow. From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. She's known as the First Lady of Song, the Queen of Jazz. Ella Jane Fitzgerald overcame poverty, abuse, and racism to build an international career that spanned seven decades and a charitable foundation in her name. We talk with Jeffrey Mark, author of Ella, a biography of the legendary Ella Fitzgerald, who walks us through the story behind the music.
When you find out about her story, it's like, goodness gracious, how did this woman survive her real life and become this icon?
We learn about some of her personal and professional relationships, her vulnerabilities, and what motivated her insatiable love of connecting to a live audience. It's On the Record after the news. Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. She is the First Lady of Song, the Queen of Jazz. Ella Jane Fitzgerald's stellar career spanned seven decades. She left an imprint on music that will last forever. It's nearly impossible to encapsulate a life so accomplished and a talent that reaches beyond words. But our guest today, Jeffrey Mark, dedicated more than a decade to researching and writing Ella, a biography of the legendary Ella Fitzgerald. Mark is also a singer, comedian, and Emmy Award winner. He's been described as a walking encyclopedia of show business history. His book is now available with a two-CD set that illustrates the scope of Ella Fitzgerald's unparalleled career. He'll be performing some of her songs at Germano's Piattini Cabaret next Wednesday, April 25th, her 101st birthday. There will also be a book signing. And now he joins us by phone from his home near Palm Springs, California. Welcome to the show, Jeffrey.
Good morning, good afternoon. You flatter me. Keep going. Wow, I feel great.
Well, let's start with you. You have roots in Baltimore, yeah?
Absolutely. Although I was born in Brooklyn, New York, which is only a three-hour drive from Baltimore, we moved there in the summer of 1967. And I spent my last 2 years of elementary school and went to Old Court Junior High and Randallstown High School. So Baltimore is very near and dear to my heart.
As somebody reads this book, they can feel your admiration and love for Ella and her music. What prompted you to write it?
I like to write about people who are the very, very best at what they do. And if you talk to musicians, if you talk to other singers, Ella, 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 it's always Ella at the top of the list. Most singers who study what is now considered the Great American Songbook, they say listen to Ella's version first and then go on and do your research. She's always the go-to point for everybody. That intrigued me, and that's why I wanted to make sure that her story was told, not just because she's the best at what she does, but when you find out about her story, it's like, goodness gracious, how did this woman survive her real life and become this icon? So I like writing about both sides of it.
And we need, obviously, to hear her voice right away. Here is a clip from Atiskit Atasket, the song that you refer to as her first monster hit. It really launched her career. Let's listen.
A tisket, a tasket, a brown and yellow basket. I send a letter to my mommy on the way. I dropped it, I dropped it, I dropped it. Yes, on the way I dropped it. A little girlie picked it up and put it in her pocket.
Did Ella Fitzgerald have control over her career?
Well, that's a good question. And the answer is probably yes, no, and maybe. when we're talking about a tisk at a task, we're going all the way back to the 1930s. Now, the clip you just played was a redo that she did in the late 1950s. But the original Tisk at a Task It was part of her time and life with Chick Webb's orchestra in the 1930s. And a Tisk at a Task It really shows you the first time she tries to take control a little bit of her career. There was a young man named Al Feldman who was the arranger for the Chick Webb Orchestra. And she came to him and said, you know, my mother used to sing me this little sing-song lullaby thing when I was going to bed as a kid. Let's swing that. And Al said, no, Ella, that's really a bad idea. And she said, oh, really? Would you like to continue to keep writing arrangements for me? Because if I won't use them, Chick Webb will fire you. And he said, by golly, Ella, that's a great idea. Let's swing a nursery rhyme.
Hardball.
He went home and wrote this arrangement and came back the next day. And she loved the arrangement, but she didn't like the lyrics. So she rewrote them using the parlance of the jive people of the day, the hipsters who came to the Savoy Ballroom to dance all night to their music. And they recorded it, and it went huge. It was a million seller across the board. It wasn't just for the African-American population. Everybody loved it. And that was the first time she put her foot down and said, no, this is going to be my way. But more often than not, her managers and agents held sway, and she did more or less what they told her to do.
Your biography of Ella Fitzgerald looks at what you call the story behind the music, too. Talk about that.
Yes. It's, well, who knew? Until you start doing research, who knew that Ella's mother died when she was a teenager? Who knew that the man who was her mother's Portuguese lover raped her and berated her and beat her? Who knew that Ella ran away and was caught and sent to a girls' reformatory where she was literally tortured? Who knew that Ella ran away to the streets of Harlem and was a numbers runner and was a lookout for prostitutes so she'd have some place to live and have a roof over her head? Who knew these things? So the more I was able to reveal, each thing I revealed made me ask 16 more questions. But the big question is, how does this girl with no support system and no family and no money and no home become this big star? She's a teenager recording her first song, and 3 years later, she's the biggest singer in the country. How does that happen? That I found fascinating, and that story is in the book.
It is fascinating. Why was it important for Ella to keep her private life and her past away from the public eye?
Well, I think it's a combination of two things. Ella Fitzgerald was an enormously shy, personally shy woman, meaning on stage, you couldn't beat her. But if you sat with her or she attended a party or was anywhere not in the public eye, tremendously shy. And then you have the times in which she becomes a star. In the 1930s and 40s, if there was anything in your background that had anything criminal or anything less than, you know, mommy and daddy and a white picket fence and the perfect childhood, people, you couldn't become a star. Everybody's background had to be sanitized for their own protection. Just most folks' backgrounds weren't as awful as Ella's was.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with author and performer Jeffrey Mark about his book, Ella, a biography of the legendary Ella Fitzgerald. He'll be signing books and performing at Germano's Piattini Cabaret next Wednesday. Let's hear another clip from Lullaby of Birdland.
Oh, Lullaby of Birdland, that's what I always hear when you sigh. Never in my word land could there be ways to reveal in a phrase how I feel. Have you ever heard?
Why was this an important song in Ella's repertoire?
Because there are eras. In every singer's life, there are eras. Ella had the era of being the big band singer in the 30s into the early 40s, and she was number one in the country for a while. Well, Chick Webb died. Her sidemen got drafted because of World War II. She inherited the big band. She was the first African-American female to lead a big band. But then she was left sort of on her own to be just another female singer. And in the 1940s, her career did a kind of a roller coaster. She'd have a song that would hit for a while, then a long time would go by, and she wouldn't have a song on the charts. She was playing theaters and nightclubs, but not the best ones. And then in the early 1950s, as her voice matured and as Norman Granz took over as her manager, although they fought constantly with the dear old Decca Records to record better things, at least things like Lullaby of Birdland started happening for her, where she had new hits, and it extended her life so that now, as a woman in her 30s, she's still a star. She's still a name act. And it was the beginning of Ella transforming from being an admired female singer to just about getting to the point where Norman completely takes over her life, and she goes from being a singer to being a superstar. But Lullaby of Birdland is a song we know only because of Ella. It was her hit, and she sang it for the rest of her life. And it's a remarkable thing. Most singers have about a five-year range where that's about all they get for being famous. And the rest of their lives, they're singing the three or four songs they made famous. Ella always kept pushing forward. There was always something new. And Lullaby of Birdland is a good example of any, as Ella in the early 1950s, swinging. Because by this point, she really was becoming the best jazz singer there was.
That's author and performer Jeffrey Mark. We're talking about his book, Ella, a biography of the legendary Ella Fitzgerald. He'll be performing and signing books at 6 p.m. next Wednesday, April 25th, at Germano's Piattini Cabaret, 300 South High Street in Little Italy. This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass. Quick break. When we're back, more of Ella's music, more about her career. We'll hear about the pivotal performance that transformed her from superstar to legend. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking this morning with Jeffrey Mark about his book, Ella, a biography of the legendary Ella Fitzgerald. He'll be performing some of her songs, telling stories, and signing books at Germano's Piattini Cabaret next Wednesday. You write at length about Ella's longtime manager and producer, Norman Granz. Talk a bit about their relationship.
Norman must be given tons and tons of credit. He was a West Coast jazz producer who, long before it became, quote-unquote, the right thing to do, felt that the bigotry in music that was happening back then was wrong. He insisted that every place his people played was integrated. He fought for African-American performers to be treated equally and with respect. And although he didn't really like Ella in the beginning, meaning he didn't get her music, once he had a chance to really see her perform live, because he was only judging this on her recorded music, he took over. And he is the one who pushed for her to sing the Great American Songbook songs. And he fought for her. He wanted to be able to record her. Decca Records didn't want to let her go. And he made this deal. Think about this. They were going to make a film of the Benny Goodman story, and they wanted to use Benny's original musicians who were all still alive. Well, they were all under personal contracts to Norman. So he said, you know what? I'll give you the musicians. You give me Ella. And Decca let her go, and Norman said, I'm starting Verve Records. Now we're going to have you singing the best. And the best was, the very first one was the Cole Porter songbook. When that came out, everybody treated Ella differently. They looked at her with a new pair of glasses and meant, my goodness gracious, this woman can sing anything and interpret anything. And for many people to this day, her versions of those Cole Porter songs are the best. And she went on to do Rodgers and Hart, Irving Berlin, Duke Ellington, George Gershwin, Harold Arlen, the great songs of the great American composers of the 20th century, sung by Ella, done to arrangements by the greatest arrangers that were, the best of which was Nelson Riddle. And that took her to superstar status.
Let's hear a clip of one of those Cole Porter songs, Miss Otis Regrets.
Miss Otis regrets she's unable to lunch today. Madam, Miss Otis regrets she's unable to lunch today. She is sorry to be delayed, but last evening down in Lover's Lane she strayed. Madam, Miss Otis.
Tell us about that song.
That's a fascinating cut because the entire album was arranged by Buddy Brigman, except for this song. It's just my friend Paul Smith playing the piano and Ella singing. Ella didn't understand the song, and it's a hard song to understand. It didn't come from a film. It didn't come from a Broadway show. Cole Porter, just to stay in practice, woke up every morning, had coffee and a cigarette, and wrote a song just to stay in practice. This is a song he wrote one day. It's very darkly humorous, and one has to understand about butlers and society people to get the lyrics. And Buddy explained the song to Ella so that she could perform it the way Porter intended it. And it is one of the best loved songs on the album. It was such a minor thing in his life that she rescued this song from obscurity. Ella turned it into a hit. Ella turned it into one of those classic forever green songs that people sing, and people are still recording it. If Ella hadn't done it, nobody else would have done it. But this is one of the songs I'll be singing at the club to the same arrangement. I don't imitate Ella. I can't. Nobody can. That's why she's the best.
That's author and performer Jeffrey Mark here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his book, Ella, a biography of the legendary Ella Fitzgerald. He'll be performing and telling stories at Germano's Piattini Cabaret next Wednesday. There's an anecdote about Ella's performance in Berlin of Mac the Knife that you say was pivotal. Before we have a listen, set it up for us. What happened?
It's 1930s Germany, and there is this musical about a slasher, and it's a big hit. And the people who wrote this, all the people involved, were Jewish and left Nazi Germany before it was too late. Came to New York. The show was produced in English, off-Broadway and on, and the same song sung in a very lugubrious, funereal way. Now, 20 years go by, and for some reason, Bobby Darin records this song as this up-tempo, finger-snapping, swinging number. And it hits number one on the charts. Louis Armstrong hears it and decides to record it for his next album. And his version hits number one on the charts. Very, very rare. So now we're in Berlin in February of 1960, and Ella is about to perform for 10,000 people in what was then called West Berlin. And Norman Granz comes backstage and says to her, Ella, I really want you to go out there and sing Mac the Knife. And Ella, being the obedient client of his, said, no, I will not sing Mac the Knife. I don't like the song. I don't understand it. I don't know the lyrics. And Norman said, we're in Germany. They don't speak English. It won't matter what you sing, but they'll recognize the tune as being German. And Paul Smith, the same pianist I spoke about a moment ago, was backstage and said, Ella, I'll play this little vamp behind you. Just sing what you want, and when you're done, we'll go on to the next thing. Who will know? Well, she went out there, introduced the song by saying, we've never heard a girl sing it, and I'm not sure I know the words. And the song is kind of like a blues. It tells a story in small stanzas. By the time she got to the third stanza, she forgot the words. I think she forgot she was in Germany. And I could rhapsodize about what she did next very longly, but I will tell you that on her feet, she wrote a brand new song. All the lyrics fit the meter of the song. All the lyrics rhymed exactly where they should have, as if she'd taken 2 or 3 months to write all of this.
And let's hear part of that. This is a clip from Mac the Knife in Berlin in 1960. This is toward the end of the song.
Bobby Darin and Louis Armstrong, they made
And she actually won Best Vocal Performance by a Female for that improvisational performance.
And Best Album. Two Grammys for that. And the audience, because Norman was wrong, the audience did understand English. And they knew exactly what she had done, the genius of what she had done. And they gave her an ovation like I've never heard. And the energy filled her so she followed that with a 7.5-minute version of How High the Moon. Those two songs together are the finest examples of jazz singing that ever have been and probably ever will be. And that's the moment she becomes a legend.
And the other thing it's an example of is her extraordinary relationship with an audience. I mean, you wrote that Ella Fitzgerald performed until she physically no longer could. What did she get from performing for a live audience?
When you're born with this kind of genius talent, and that applies to so few people, it's part of your DNA to use that talent. Here is a woman, I've already told you about her background, the awful things she had to live through, living through being an African-American. I mean, it's not easy today. In the 1930s and 40s and 50s, it was just plain awful. And women were not treated with equality back then. So she has all of these barriers. Where does she get acceptance? On the stage. Where does she get consistent love? On the stage. Ella loved her audiences even more than we loved her and had as much respect for us as we had for her. So she never wanted to retire or not be in front of them. Literally, like you said, until she could no longer get out on a stage. Into the early 1990s, this is a 7-decade career. Ella was out there making us happy because we made her happy.
You saw her perform more than 24 times.
Yes.
What was it like for you to experience that?
That electricity between her and the audiences. I've been lucky. I've growing up in Baltimore and New York, I've seen hundreds of famous people perform live. It was different with Ella. It wasn't just a clack of people or a specific following or gay men screaming for her. It was everybody. You went in the audience. There were African-Americans and Caucasian people and Asian people and Latino people and young and old and straight and gay and conservative and liberal. Across the board, everybody came together and was just entranced by her. There were times, like at Carnegie Hall, people's feet were stomping so much, I was afraid the building was going to collapse. I heard one person say the audience went so crazy they started unscrewing the furniture. That's how the audiences reacted to her. Not in a drugged frenzy, not drunken, just from their hearts, the energy that came out towards her. I've never seen anything like that.
She left such a legacy of music, and there's also an Ella Fitzgerald Charitable Foundation. What does it do?
Her money that she left behind when she passed away has gone into the Ella Fitzgerald Charitable Foundation. It's a foundation that helps the working poor stay afloat. And this was very, very close to Ella's heart. It's why she made sure, after she was no longer here to give to charity, that there'd be a charity to help the kind of people she liked to help. Good people, hardworking people, who for whatever reasons are struggling. A portion of the book is going to the charity. Some of the money I earn on the road is going to the charity. And I heartily suggest you folks out there, if there's a charity you want to support, go look at the Ella Fitzgerald Charitable Foundation.
What can patrons expect at your performance at Germano's next week?
A lot of emotion, because as it turns out, some old high school chums I haven't seen in 4 decades are going to be there to cheer me on. So I will be reminiscing about Ella. I'll also be reminiscing about living in Baltimore, what Baltimore was like in the 1960s and 1970s, what my high school was like. Randallstown High School was the number 2 high school in the country back then, besides Beverly Hills High. So I'll be talking about me. I'll be talking about Ella, singing her songs, and hopefully feeling the love. I have never performed for my peers before from high school. This will be a first. So it'll be a very, very special night. And I'd love to share with as many people who can come.
Thanks for this conversation. Thanks a lot.
Oh, it is my pleasure to be with you and to be in Baltimore.
Geoffrey Mark wrote Ella, a biography of the legendary Ella Fitzgerald. He'll be performing and telling stories next Wednesday, April 25th, Ella Fitzgerald's 101st birthday, at 6 p.m. at Germano's Piattini Cabaret, 300 South High Street, Little Italy, Baltimore. He'll also sign books. We have a link to information about the book and the cabaret performance at the On the Record page at wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for listening On the Record. Join us again tomorrow.